everybody wants to know the secret to happiness.
Is that what we're doing tonight? Oh, that's tomorrow. Tonight's the night of suffering. Bye, everybody. Well, I admit that was an outrageous title, and I hope you didn't really take it seriously. They did, huh?
Somebody who couldn't be here was like, well, you have to tell me as soon as you find out. Email me.
I asked Salim's daughter what the secret of happiness was, and she said, be happy.
Yeah.
There you go.
I don't really believe, can you hear in the back? Because that's full volume. I don't believe that we can get the secret of happiness in words. And I think even if we all had profoundly happy experiences tonight, which I hope we do, that it would necessarily change the conditioning of our whole life and all that we attune to as we came into this life, all of the previous generations that are now living in us and through us. But I see that people are, this is going to sound worse than the title, people are much more miserable than they have to be. And it hurts me, because we can do something about our minds and the state of our happiness if we begin to find out a little bit more about who we are. I think if you went to a physician and you said, out of 1,000 people, how many people are 100% healthy? And without going into debate about what health is, the number would be small. And if you were able to look at people and really see if people are happy or not happy, out of 1,000,000 people, there would be very few who are really happy. Now, happiness, not to define it, but just to look at it, happiness is different from pleasure. There are moments when we have great pleasure, but we still can be pained, suffering, and unhappy. And happiness is not necessarily the absence of suffering. In life, there's struggle and there's suffering. We'll speak about it tonight. But it doesn't mean, as absurd as it might sound, that one can't be happy in the midst of struggle. Actually, happiness is only real if you can touch it in the midst of struggle. Otherwise, it's just concepts of the mind. So,
some spaces up here if they want to move up here.
You know, if everybody, I don't know if we did this already, you want to come in a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Nicer anyway.
There's a couple of spots up here too if anybody wants to move up.
There's a seat here.
So I've had a very lucky life, really kind of a super lucky life. And maybe not lucky in the way that most people might think of luck, but in the way that I do, I feel not just blessed, but quite fortunate. And I've traveled for the last 45 years, I guess more now, getting older, and studied with many great teachers, or with great teachers, I can't say many, but great teachers all over the world. And what I've learned is that these people with magnetism, these people with strength, these people who are real healers without saying I'm a this or I'm a that, who have no labels except the ones that they take on conveniently, have a certain quality, an unnameable quality. And that quality is in every human being. It is not in special human beings. Every human being has this innate quality, this unnameable, purposely unnameable quality. It manifests differently in each of us. And in many situations, it actually conflicts with our own desires. And out of that conflict, oftentimes this quality becomes, I won't say diminished, because that can't exactly become diminished, but it gets squished, you know, it gets crushed, it gets hidden. And then we begin to develop an attitude in life that reinforces the very thing that we're trying to overcome. The problem is, one of the problems, not just one, nobody can do this for us. The greatest teachers in the universe, if Jesus Christ came back and put his hand on you and you were totally illumined, if you were a miserable cuss before, you would be a miserable cuss afterwards. Because eventually we drop back into our conditioning. Unless we recognize that we, each of us, have individual power. And it is that power, not ego power, but that power that is coming through those whom we say are enlightened, or those whom we say have the gift. The mind says, well, if that's the case, why don't we all just find this? How hard could it be? If you look at life, you find that there are difficulties in life, and it's very difficult to get beyond the apparent. I see so many people who are conditioned, I do this myself so I can speak freely, who are conditioned to go for the immediate rather than the important. And that tendency, by the way, seems to be getting worse and worse. So that the immediate blocks out the important after a while, and we just become reactive human beings. So what can we do? Well, I'll give you the Sufi answer first. How many people don't know what Sufism is? Okay, just so we're clear. Right, yeah, just. I really don't know. I know that the last seminar I gave, a couple of people walked out on because I wasn't being what they expected a Sufi to be, and many times in life I've said to many Sufis, well, you know, if you're a Sufi, then I'm not, because I'm not what that is, what people expect. But ideally, there is an unbroken stream of wisdom and love that comes through to all human beings. If you touch it, you're a Sufi. You can call it a Buddhist, you can call it anything you want. Sufi is just a convenient term. But it's when you touch it, it counts. And some of the people who touch this stream come together, and culturally they would come together in different cultures, and now that we have a global culture, there is this global group of people who are consciously touching this stream. They don't all have the same name or belong to the same ism, and that's the way it should be, because we now have a global culture. So the Sufi teaching, or the Buddhist teaching, or the yogic teaching, is pretty simple to put into words. And if there is a secret of happiness, which maybe there is, this is it. So you can all leave after this if you want. But It's a very interesting idea. The secret is to be attuned with the infinite and harmonious with the finite. And it sounds pretty simple. Attuned with the infinite and being in a state of harmony with the finite, with the conditions of our life. And what does it mean? Well, I'll tell you a very profound story. It happened to me day before yesterday. I was in San Rafael in California, and I was at the Whole Foods. And I have my loyalty. And there was a long line waiting at the sandwich counter. And so I got at the end of the line, and there were people on the sides kind of cutting it. It was like India. I don't know if you've ever been in a queue in India. Well, you couldn't be, because there is no such thing as a queue in India. It's a scene. And I waited patiently, and I was behaving myself. And finally, there were three or four people making the sandwiches, and one looked up at me and said, "Next." So I stepped forward and started to describe the sandwich I want, which is unusual. And suddenly, some man comes rushing in and kind of bumps into me, and he said, "There's a line here, you know, and I'm next." And I didn't say lovingly, "Okay, you're next, fine." I said, "All right, she called me and I came, but if you're next, I'm sorry, go ahead." And then immediately the next sandwich maker opened up. So I was in position next to this guy. And of course, my sandwich was not just a number 6 or a number 3, but it was odd to begin with. And he was just glaring at me while his sandwich was being made. And I stopped for a moment and I said, "I'm not carrying this. I have no reason to carry this, and I have no desire to carry this." And I started to do an inner practice. After 10 seconds, he turned to me and said, "I'm so sorry. Two people cut in front of me, and I'm hungry, and I really apologize. I should not have snapped at you." So I put my arm around him, and I said, "I am so used to it. It's fine." He started laughing, and I started laughing, and, you know, we chatted. And so they make the two sandwiches, and he takes his sandwich, and as he's walking away, he turns to me, and he said, "Okay, I'll go home and do a little more compassion and forgiveness of self meditation." I said, "Right." So, now the key to the story was not the practice, but the key was that moment of my realization, I don't want to carry this. I really don't want to do this. I have no reason to react. You know, my life is not changed unless I hold on to this. So what does the practice do, any real practice? Well, it does attune us to the infinite. The infinite is not some concept out there. You know, the infinite is the infinite. There is no other than the infinite except what we separate by dint of our minds into the finite. If we all, including myself, get nothing else out of tonight, it is simply this. We as human beings have the power to attune with the infinite. When we are attuned with the infinite, we are a human being. When we're not attuned with the infinite, we're not really a human being. Why? The word human comes from two Sanskrit words, even though we say it in English all the time. The two words are manas, which means mind, and hu, which means God. God, mind. And what does that mean, God, mind, before we jump into a conceptual understanding? First, I'd like to make an assumption. Hopefully it'll fit in with your belief system, because it's just a part of a belief system, but there is nothing that isn't God. There is nothing that isn't God. Nothing at all, whether physical, mental, emotional, whether imaginary or concrete, there is nothing that isn't God. That means evil is God, good is God, all of it is part of the infinite. And as the Buddha said, as a thing is viewed, so it appears. That which we look at as darkness, evil, even if we have to struggle against it, sometimes you actually have to do battle, it still is God that you're doing battle with. So there is nothing that isn't God. And, you know, we hear in scriptures of different religions, God is love, but I'd like to back that up for a minute and say that God is intelligence. Not reasoning, but pure cosmic intelligence. And if you have a rock, there is very, very little intelligence in that rock. But it is God, nevertheless. The proof of that is the evolution of rocks into a gemstone, which we all look at and value, and pay in some cases huge sums of money for a rock. Why? Why do we value those gemstones besides durability and everything else? Because it is the highest evolution of the rock. And what does it represent? Well, it represents the dawning of love in the rock world. And we long for that. We long for the evolution of this intelligence. So then this intelligence evolves further into plants and trees. And we go, whoa, that beautiful flower in our subconscious, frankly, has more love in it, has more manifestation of the divine intelligence than the rock does sitting here. Well, we don't have a rock here, but if we did. And we look at flowers and we're uplifted and we feel a certain sense of joy. Why? Because there's a greater evolution of the divine intelligence manifesting as love in the trees, in the flowers, in the plants, in the plant kingdom. And then what happens? Well, that the evolutionary process of the divine intelligence comes even closer to the surface as what? As an animal, as a bird. And we watch it happening. You know, frankly, it's a little more difficult to fall in love with an earthworm than it is with your puppy that lives at home. And nothing against earthworms. My garden is full of them. But why? Because the pet that lives within us gets closer and closer to the human condition and ultimately really picks up a lot of that magnetism that is the divine intelligence now manifesting as love. And so we think we're loving our puppy. We're loving the love in the puppy. That's why human beings love dogs. And then it goes further still, and the highest manifestation of the intelligence as love is hu manas, God mind, the human being. But we lose connection on purpose with that perfection. Why do I say on purpose? Well, there is some kind of cosmic intelligence working behind the entirety. And that intelligence has set up a world that pulls us into separation from at-one-ment, from the oneness, from love. And you think, now why would it do that? Well, it does it for the same reason that a rock is not a dog. That there is more and more evolution continually going on. Who is evolving? What's evolving? What's evolving is this perfected intelligence is becoming more and more aware of its ability as love. So, in a sense, the scriptures who say God is love are speaking about a condition that has many different possibilities depending upon the time. So when this world was molten, or gaseous, then molten, it had the potential for the divine intelligence to experience itself, but it wasn't actually able to experience itself yet. Now, we don't like to hear this. We like God to be perfect. We like God to be fixed. We like God, frankly, to be dead. Why? Because then we can control God. So we like God to fit into our comfortable notions, and when those comfortable notions begin to get uncomfortable, we run in the other direction. But what is evolving here on planet Earth and in our universe and in other universes is not you and I, but the divine within us that's evolving. Now, some people don't like the word divine, maybe for good reason. So the intelligence, the perfection within us, the potential for experiencing unity within us is continually evolving. Our ability to feel and project love is evolving as we evolve. And what stands in the way? Well, struggle is built in, but so is the ability to overcome. It's built into each of us. You know, my parents are still alive. They're in their mid-90s. They were invested in this wonderful investment for 40 years that was run by a guy named Bernie Madoff. When they were in their young 90s, they lost every penny they had. And obviously that was what they were living on. They lost everything. They had maybe $1,000 in a checking account, and that was it. And I said, whoa, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Well, they're stubborn people, but they also have some faith that is unyielding. And so what's going to happen? Well, we're going to struggle and we're going to complain and we're going to suffer, but we're going forward. We're not going backward. And that's how they've lived. And regardless of their psychological condition, there is a great lesson there. There is struggle in life. They were invested in this scheme for 40 years. They had no reason to believe that there was anything wrong about it. The SEC confirmed it 14 times that this was fine. But it didn't work out that way. It wasn't fine. It wasn't what they had planned. So what was it for them? It was an opportunity. And not a pleasant opportunity, not a wonderful opportunity, not a thrilling opportunity. It was an obnoxious opportunity, but it was an opportunity to go forward. And they did. And they're still alive and they're still kicking. This is an aside, but they appealed for something to the IRS and they didn't get an answer. So my mother got on the phone with the IRS, which most people don't do willingly, and did not hang up for 4 hours until she got the director's office. I could not get the director of the IRS, but my mother did. So what does it show? Well, there is a certain kind of willpower. There's ego and there's everything else, but there's willpower. There's this power within us that represents the divine intelligence transforming itself through the struggle into love. So we said the title tonight is The Secret of Happiness. It doesn't mean that there is not going to be struggle in life. There is struggle, it's real. And if you are trying to make a life that's free from struggle, it's not going to happen. If it does, you're dead. Or you recognize the gift that each struggle potentially can be. So back to the premise. What did I say were the two things that we had to do concurrently? We had to always attune to the infinite. And I won't say always, as much as we can, attune to the infinite until it becomes habit. And
be harmonious with our...
be harmonious with the finite. That's the tough one. Mystics take four different ways to do this. One way, actually, I'm just going to double check my notes.
Wow, you have notes?
I always have notes, but I never double check them. But I want to get this really right. I just have to get to the right talk. You didn't know I had notes, huh?
No.
Wow, how exciting. The secrets are in the rugs. Everything that we've thought and felt. Okay, there are four ways to get in touch with the infinite. Four basic ways. These are really from three mystical paths. There are many more mystical paths, but this is from yoga, the yogic path, the Buddhist path, and the Sufi path. And they all represent these four ways. First way is the way of the intellect. Using our intelligence to look at every struggle that presents itself in life and to understand the other point of view of that struggle, whatever it is. So when someone comes up to me and says, "You jerk, you cut in front of me in the line," I can use my intelligence to attune to the infinite. I don't have to carry this. I'm not here for this. Or I can, depending upon our ability to see a little deeply, you know, I can see and say, wow, this guy's having a rough day. What's going on here? I don't have to be kind and loving, but I can use my mind to look instead of using that part of me that reacts. So that's the way of the intellect, the use of the mind. It is effective for some people, and it is terrible for others. You'll need to find out what works best for you. Some people, when they use the mind, they overuse the mind, and then they don't know how to shut it off. And so instead of just saying, that guy had a rough day, and he was hungry, and he, you know, he cut in front of me, suddenly it's, why was that? Why did he do that? I'll bet you he had problems with his mother. Wait a second, I have problems with my mother. My mother, I can't stand what she did to, and on and on and on. That person should not use the way of the intellect. They really shouldn't. It is detrimental rather than helpful. That's why the idea that there's one answer for all people is absurd. Just absurd. The next is a way that's not too popular now. It's the way of abstinence. This way works, but it doesn't work well in the culture we have now. It worked well when we had more monastic possibilities for both men and women, when you could remove yourself from the world and abstain from all of the pleasures of life. When you can say, I'm shutting down my senses, I'm just going to go into an inner condition, and I'm totally happy doing that. I will find my clear path doing that. There are still some people who can do this, but you know, I've been in some very hidden places in the Himalayas in India, and I've been with some swamis who are living lives of renunciation, and they are, forgive me, but they are greedier and they are less kind than everybody sitting in this room. And they're living a life of abstinence, but they have not attained the ability to abstain within. And so they are living in anguish because they're living a life that's not real. They can talk the talk, but they can't walk the walk, and they're suffering. And it was very difficult to see. I went there with one of my teachers, with Pirvalayan, and you know, we came out of some of these places, and I was appalled because I sensed what was going on. And Pirvalayan said, "Well, you know, this is not the way for any sane human being. And there are very few who can really live this. You have to go beyond desire, not just by saying you're beyond desire." And you know, quite frankly, it has not been uncommon in the last 30, 40 years to see many spiritual teachers who are way out of line with their relationship with their students. Why? It's the same thing. It's this wonderful psychic and spiritual power, but without a container that has been trained strongly enough to hold it. And I'm not speaking from someone who has not committed the same errors. You know, I've committed the same errors and hopefully learned from them. But I didn't have a particular attachment to defending what I do as right. You know, I could look at it and say, that's a bit of a mess you've created, you know, and try and heal it. But part of life and part of growing is that every human being that grows leaves a path of destruction behind them. Now, hopefully that's not the only path you leave. But it's just like the seeds. When the seeds begin to germinate, the outer part of the shell has to first crack and then rot. And, you know, if you do gardening, you know, it also gives off a bit of an odor sometimes. So all of us make mistakes. It's what we do with them. It's where we're going that really matters. And our ability to correct what we can, not to be proud of it. So that's abstinence. The third way is a very interesting way. The third way is righteousness in the world. And this is a way that we might call karma yoga service in the world. But it's not just service. It's righteous actions so that your heart mind is focused on doing actions that are proper. And not just from some mental condition, I said your heart mind. So, you know, if you help someone across the street and afterwards you're thinking, wow, that was great, I helped someone across the street, well, it's a good action, but it's not righteous. A righteous action is helping someone across the street, and that's that. And there's a wonderful story, maybe you all know it, but the good one should be told again and again. It's a Zen story about a monk and a teacher, and they come to a river. And in this particular order of Zen monks, they were not allowed to touch women. It was the worst sin you could commit, touching women. So they get to the riverbank, and the ferry is not there, of course. That day, the ferry got washed away. And there's a young woman who arrives at the same time who needs to cross the river. So the teacher picks up the woman, carries her across the river, and puts her down and begins walking. And they walk for hours, and finally the student blows up. How could you? You're the Roshi, and you know, you're the head of the order, and how could you? I've been following you for all these years, and blah, blah, blah. And the teacher turns and says, "How could I what? How could you pick up that woman?" And the teacher said, "Oh, that. Well, I picked up the woman, you're right. I carried her across the river and I put her down. But you've been carrying her ever since." And, you know, it's a good story. And the message is really real. We make mistakes, all of us. That's part of the struggle. So the guy at the sandwich counter, besides going home and doing the meditation on compassion, said, "I also need to do the meditation on self-forgiveness." Self-forgiveness. Good meditation. And the last one is when the intelligence that I spoke of is coupled with love. And the love directs the intelligence. And this is the path of today, by the way. The others, although they have their place, for the most part, they're not the path of today. We think, oh, if I could only be indifferent and detached and so on. And I remember going to another teacher, Sam Lewis, this madman who was completely full of love and light and joy and didn't care what anybody in the world thought about him because he was full of love, as long as he was full of love. And I said to him, Murshid, that was his title, I said, Murshid, I'm very worried. I'm afraid that I've become too attached. How do I get over attachment in life? And he was about 5 feet tall, and he looked at me and he said, You never have to worry about attachment. What you have to worry about is detachment. Get attached. And it was an interesting comment that's proven as great guidance for the rest of my life. Because I see how easy it is for me to withdraw from a situation. And it's not necessarily the way to go. Sometimes it's much, much, much healthier to get attached to the situation, attuned to the infinite, and live it. And yes, we all who begin to touch the infinite are going to create some chaos. Now, I'm thinking, this must be a great night. All these teachers that I had are coming here. There was another luminary called Joe Miller. That was his spiritual name. And I remember in the 60s, we used to have these holy man jams when all of the gurus of the day would get up on one stage and we would sit there, usually in San Francisco, and full of adoration. And there was a new guru in town. Some of you might know Yogi Bhajan. He's not alive anymore, but so Yogi Bhajan has been in the States at that time for maybe a year. And he was just starting to give his teaching, and he was on stage, and Pirvalayat was there, and Joe, and Murshid Sen, and Steve Gaskin was there, and a few others, I forget who, Swami Satchidananda. And they each gave a little rap for a few minutes, and then they would take questions from the audience, and this young woman, it was a girl, she probably was 16, stood up and in kind of a timid voice asked Yogi Bhajan a question about being genuine and how he knew he was genuine, something like that. And he was new, and everything was kind of new, the interaction between Western people on a spiritual path and Easterners is very different. On the Eastern path, you never question the guru. You never even ask the guru anything. You know, you accept the word of the guru and that's it. Otherwise, don't have a guru. But in the West, we're kind of do-it-yourselfers. We like to push things a little bit and see where they're going. And frankly, I think it's quite healthy. And more of that's happening in the East. And we're getting a little bit more of the Eastern way in the West. So she asked this question. And Yogi Bhajan started to just scream at her and berate her. And Joe Miller stood up, and Yogi Bhajan used to wear just white in those days with a white turban, you know. And he said, "Hey, white man!" And the whole place got really still. I mean, really, really still. And Yogi Bhajan turns and he looks at Joe Miller, who's beaming light. And Joe Miller says, "If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen." To his credit, Yogi Bhajan sat down and said, "Thank you, Joe Miller." Really. So, Joe Miller, the Dalai Lama said, Joe Miller knew more about Buddhism than anyone he's ever met in the West, and he said, and probably in the East too. And this is way off what we're going. Maybe not, though. Who cares? When Tibet first opened up, I was very afraid they were going to close it again. The Chinese were going to close it. And I really wanted to go. So I went. It was astounding. It was before hotels or anything. It was a rough trip. I came home, and I said to Catherine, to my wife, we got to go back. And she was all for it. So we went back, like 2 months later, 3 months later. Mm-hmm. And we went with a friend of ours who was Tibetan but had gotten out when he was a young boy and had, I think at the time, a Nepali passport. And so they let him in. They didn't know that he was Tibetan. And we went in, and he had been a monk for the first 19 years, and he was from a family of artists, and he was trained as a tanka painter. You all know Tibetan painting. And he still is one of the two greatest tanka painters on the planet. Anyway, he took us to places really out of the way. We would ditch our Chinese guide quickly and go to these different places, and he took us into this temple that was hidden away, and he had to get a guy to open it. And we go into this temple, and there is a picture on the wall, a fresco, I guess, of the Buddha with the arhats. The arhats are the enlightened ones who came down with the Buddha. And I look at one of them, and it's Joe Miller. I mean, it's Joe Miller. Now, you can't take pictures in these places. And you're kind of on your honor to not take pictures. Well, I took a picture. And I thought, you know. And I came back and I showed it to Joe. I didn't say a word. And I put it down. And he started laughing and laughing and laughing. And he said, yeah, it's me. So there were and there are some truly wonderful people. Why? And this is the key thing. Why? Because their intelligence is directed by their love. What directs our intelligence? You know, reaction, fear, conditioning, doubt. Good things too. I mean, it's not all darkness. What can we do? What can we really do? Well, one thing is to have some true patience, not false patience, but true patience. The process takes time. Along the way, I hope you have some wonderfully illuminating experiences. It's very difficult to be on a spiritual path and never have any spiritual experiences. I always tell people, if really that's what's happening, go to a different path, get a different teacher, do something else. But you should have, and I say, I rarely use the word should, but you should have moments of powerful spiritual awakening. And if that's not there, at least talk to someone who's guiding you. And if you don't have a guide, you don't have to have a guide. It's easier with a guide, but you don't have to have one. If you don't have a guide, at least get some books or do something so that you begin to have powerful experiences, because that overcomes the limited ego. And the other thing is, there are many things to do, but meditation really helps. And you cannot do meditation unless you learn concentration. Prayer helps. Whatever prayer means to you, prayer helps. Sound helps. Sound is just terribly important. Sound is really terribly important. It is that which goes beyond the limited mind and cuts right through to our core. And sound that came through revelation, regardless of whatever path or prophet or wise woman or man it came through, that sound has particular power. So if we say, Our Father who art in heaven, that has one effect. If we say abundabashamaya, that has a different effect. Why? Because abundabashamaya is the Aramaic, and that's what Jesus said. He never said, our Father who art in heaven. And abundabashamaya doesn't even mean our Father who art in heaven. But the sound is really important. The yogis, you know, we practice hatha yoga, and it's become quite popular. It's a pity that mantric yoga is not as popular as hatha yoga, because it would have a much more profound effect. Forgive me, hatha yogis. But it really would. Sound cuts through the core quicker than hatha yoga. So there are ways to help the love come through the intelligence. And when we practice that on a moment-by-moment basis, whenever we remember, we create a change in the habit that has become ourselves. All we are is a series of habits. That's what the energy goes through. So something happens, and we react to what happens. That reaction is a habit. And I'll tell you another Yogi Bhajan story, but it's not really about Yogi Bhajan. It is about Joe Miller, though, come to think of it. And it's a story about Joe's Zen teacher, Dr. Sho. Dr. Sho is the head of the Buddhist community in Korea, and he was a great Zen practitioner. Some of you might, anybody ever see him? He came to America every year for a few weeks because he had some way of collecting Social Security. I never got that story, but he did. And so Joe used to take us every Thursday on a walk. That was his practice. Anybody who showed up in Golden Gate Park, you could walk through the park with Joe and his wife, Gwen, and we would stop, and anybody could offer any spiritual practice or dance or tell a story, whatever you wanted. And he said, oh, my Zen teacher is coming in a month, and all of you, it would be great to meet him, and so on. And then every week he would say, Dr. Sho is coming, and Dr. Sho is coming, and Dr. Sho is coming. Finally, the day arrives, and Dr. Sho arrives. He's a beautiful man in gray silk, I guess, and with a face that his cheeks were beaming light. And we walk on the walk a little bit, and they used to be, it's not there anymore, in Golden Gate Park, a little place where they had cut out redwood logs into benches. And it was a little grove, and it could hold maybe 60, 70 people. And we all sat there, and Joe stood up and gave the introduction to Dr. Sho and listed all of his initiations, we would call them, or confirmations about Dr. Sho, what a great Zen teacher he was. And Dr. Sho starts to speak and is giving this beautiful talk about Zen. If you can ever talk about Zen, in that moment he was. And he talks for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then Joe Miller stands up in the back and says, all right, Sho, that's enough out of you. Sit down. All of us are quite stunned, to say the least. Dr. Sho looks at Joe Miller. He says, that Joe Miller is so funny. I'll sit down now. No reaction. Now, we find that unusual, because if someone did that to us, you know, if I was giving my talk here and Deborah said, all right, Charmony, that's enough out of you, I actually might enjoy it, actually.
But great, let's go eat dessert.
Right. No, let's go have a meal.
Be careful.
So, our lives are a series of action and reaction. And every few years, I and a few of my friends, Casey being the key one, teach young people. You have to be young to get into this course, and it goes on. The first one was 5 months every day. And I think now we're down to 3 months or something. And one of the things we do is a very simple exercise, and we all love it. We have pillows like this bolster, well, that bolster that you're sitting on, but they're more flat. And we take this bolster and we go up to someone and just smash them in the back. It doesn't hurt you. And then we smash them again. Not me. Everybody does it to each other. We smash them again and smash them again. And you don't know when it's coming. And we do this until you can just stand there. And it doesn't matter when it comes, if it comes. There's no anticipation. There's no shock when it comes. And it's training. And it's training for life, because we're constantly getting assaulted. We're constantly making life and death decisions that we make out of reaction, not out of intelligence. So it's a simple exercise. And what does it do? Well, it makes us aware of our conditioned response. It makes us aware of the habit that we really are. And we don't need to be that. So meditation helps, concentration helps, contemplation helps, sound helps, working with the body. Postures is incredibly helpful, even though I said what I said. Really, postures of the body is a great way to change our conditioning. And if you think about it, when you do react, everything gets tense. So if you can not react, you don't have that tension. And that tension is sin. That's what sin is. It's that tension. It's not allowing the flow of being human to come through us. So this is what a teacher is supposed to teach. These phenomenal experiences are not given by a teacher. They come from God. And the teacher is not God. The teacher is God in the sense that everything is God. But the teacher is not God. They are separate. On purpose. If someone was absolutely God intoxicated continually, they would not offer us anything. They really wouldn't. They couldn't. They'd be by themselves anyway. You know, what are the most painful incarnations you can have? The incarnation of the prophet or the prophetess. The real one. Why? Because one end is in heaven. And one end is in absolute limitation. And that's the deeper meaning of the crucifixion of Jesus. Is that on earth we are crucified. All of us. And life here is not to get out of the crucifixion, but to focus on the resurrection. And that was the message quite clearly. And I personally believe that when Jesus was on the cross and he said, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" It was not Jesus speaking about God. I think that's actually blasphemous, quite frankly. But it was God speaking through and speaking to human beings through the mouth of Jesus. And that teaching is our obligation. To connect with the infinite. Stay connected with the infinite. That's our challenge too. So, I could go on indefinitely as God wills, but I think I'll ask if there are any questions, and then we'll do something that's more fun than listening to me. Any questions? Come on. You can't be serious. Yes?
You said that a second ago, you just said touching the infinite. It reminded me that a few minutes ago you said that touching the infinite can, I think you said, cause or bring on chaos?
Yes. Something like that.
I wonder about
Do you want that not to be true? You have chickens. I know you have chickens.
Yes.
And
they have us.
They have you, right. And they might not be known as the world's best eggs, but they're pretty good. Do you eat them? You make believe Deborah's not here. No, the eggs.
I personally do, yes.
Okay. And you eat them with the shell?
No.
Why?
The shell doesn't taste good. I don't digest it well.
Exactly. That's the answer to your question. What we're doing when we are touching the infinite is we're breaking the shell. And we don't want it anymore because we can't get the egg. If we want the shell with the egg is not tasty. So we have to create breaking the shell in order to get at the egg. That breaking the shell is chaotic. It's what you do when you crack an egg. It's not smooth and beautiful by definition. You're taking a perfect form and you're cracking it. It comes into little pieces, which you don't need anymore to protect the yolk and the white, because you're going to eat it now, so you don't need to protect it. So when this chaos is occurring, what we're doing is giving up one layer of that protection that we needed, or at least thought we needed. But initially, from the point of view of the chicken, if the chicken had a human mind, it might not love the idea of cracking the egg, because that's not what it intended the egg to be. The chicken had another intention. So a force greater than the chicken is creating chaos, and out of that chaos comes growth. The egg becomes then part of you, literally. So.
But even in the ultimate use of the egg, if the chick is born, it breaks the egg too.
Correct. It creates chaos so that it can be born. How many people here have been at a birth? Great. You know, a birth is not like the books, and it's not like the movies. It is what it is. The energy is huge. Huge. And a birth is a surrender. And yet, it's not a surrender where you lie back and say, all right, whatever happens, happens. It's a surrender, but it also is something that you're part of. You know, it's not separate from us. So, yeah, there's chaos. Or, no, forgive me, but that's absolutely wrong. And I really mean it, absolutely wrong. There's that which appears as chaos. There is no such thing as chaos. There's only love. But there is that which appears as chaos. I mean, there's evil in this world, but if we could see it from the divine point of view, in a sense, there would be no evil. But our eyes are veiled, so we don't see that point of view. So that we can, if necessary, struggle against evil. Which I probably should mention because we're speaking about happiness, which is fighting and struggling. The greatest souls are the ones who are the first to reach out their hand towards the enemy. The least souls are the ones who refuse. So when all of these masters and prophets and prophetesses were saying, you know, love your enemy, they were saying it for our benefit, for selfish reasons. If you want to be happier, reach your hand out to your enemy. If you don't want to be happy, then don't do it. Now, what do you do if you reach your hand out and it doesn't work out as planned? Well, then you have to struggle. But the struggle should not be your first reaction. Your first reaction should always come from the stream of pure love. And then if that doesn't work, then there are other actions to take. And there's a wonderful story told about Hazrat Ali, Maybe I told it even the last time I was here. No. Ali was the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. And he was the greatest fighter, the greatest swordsman in the army of Islam at the time of the Prophet. And at that time, the way they fought battles was the champion from each side would come out first. This was not new. You all heard the story of David and Goliath. Goliath was the champion, and David was the champion by default. Nobody else wanted the job against this giant. Well, Ali came out one day before a battle to fight the champion of the other side, and they dueled, I guess, with swords. And Ali won and knocked the guy to the ground and was about to kill him, because that's what you did. And the guy spit in Ali's face. And Ali took his sword, put it away, and started to walk away. And the guy was so shocked, because when you fought with the expectation that if you lost, you were going to be killed. And he came up to Ali and he said, "What happened? Why didn't you kill me? That's the rules of honor. You've dishonored me." And Ali looked at him and he said, "No, when you spit in my face, you really made me angry." And he said, "I have never killed anybody out of anger, and I never will." So, first, always extend the open hand. And we don't battle with swords anymore, or clubs, I hope, or weapons. We battle with our tongue. And this is what I see more and more. It's not people physically assaulting each other, but the energy is still there. And we don't know what to do with that energy because we're not trained to deal with it. So what we do is we assault each other, sometimes in the name of humor, with our words. And although I'm concerned with what goes into my mouth, with what I eat, I'm much more concerned with what comes out of it. If I eat the wrong foods, I can cause harm to myself. If I say the wrong words, I cause harm to others and myself. And for what? For a momentary pleasure? To say to somebody you don't even know at a sandwich line, "You big jerk," you know, is that what we're really here for? Does that make us feel good? Yeah, it relieves an itch for a moment. But the one who can control it actually develops much greater power. Any other questions?
For the Ali, was that harmonizing?
Oh, that's a great question. The question was, the story about Ali, was it harmonizing with the finite, or was it attuning to the infinite? Well, he lost harmony with the finite when the guy spit in his face. He regained it by attuning to the infinite. That's what stopped the sword. So very, very interesting. Well, if you don't have any more questions, I'll ask you some. I mean it. Why not?
Hey, Shavani, that's enough out of you.
Okay, let's go home. So I have a question. Of all of these words that you've heard for the last hour and 10 minutes, what do you remember? What do you remember most? What's relevant, if anything? And you won't hurt my feelings if you say it's all hogwash.
Love. I want to make sound.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I mean to
get. We're getting there, David. We're getting there.
Attuned to the infinite, harmonize with the finite.
Attuned to the infinite, harmonize with the finite. Everyone has the same...
Same voice.
Same voice.
Thing, and they say everybody's the same.
Yeah. Who else? Somebody said something.
Yeah, love. Everything is God.
Everything is God, and God is evolving love so that more intelligence, more of the divine intelligence can come through. You know, it's intoxicating to get pessimistic. People love to be pessimistic. And I took a look once at history to see how many references I could find to the world coming to an end in the next 10 years. And you know what? Tons and tons and tons.
Millions of hits.
Yeah. Not just this 10 years, the last 10 years, the last 10 years, back to pre-Greek times. There was always somebody who was saying, we better get it together because the world's coming to an end tomorrow. So there must be something in the human psyche that longs for this. As far as I know, it has not come to an end yet. Yes?
Yeah, I was, your story about the gentleman in the sandwich. Oh, first of all, I like the thing you said about having one end in heaven. And but that story about the sandwich line, to me, signifies or touches on like our primal happiness needing to be in line with our soulful, our spiritual happiness. Like, you know, the gentleman was hungry.
Yeah.
Therefore, he couldn't, you know, just let you get your sandwich. So I'm just wondering how you feel about how those like primal fears touch off the inability to be happy.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks.
But will I be able to, you know, buy groceries? Will I be able to be here at this or, you know what I mean? This,
yeah, I
these
do.
Things, sleep enough. Those. Oh,
sleep enough? no. I have my own thoughts about sleep. I think we. It doesn't matter. Can I function in the world and still keep that line tied to the infinite? Absolutely. Not I, anyone. Absolutely. And what does it do? Well, instead of making the world more sober, it makes the world lighter, and this is my experience, and makes the world happier. Because the thing that robs our happiness is self-centeredness, is focusing totally on the self. Now, yes, we need to maintain certain boundaries. That's part of the game of being here. And yes, we need to function in this world. But overcoming, through our wisdom, through our prayer, through our zikr, through our practice, overcoming that attachment to preserve the limited self at all costs makes life much more interesting and much more enjoyable. And, you know, I said being in rhythm with the finite. Being in rhythm with the finite means it's music. It means knowing what part of the symphony to bring in at any moment. Not knowing intellectually, but knowing by overcoming our animal instincts. And when that happens, our senses begin to function a little bit differently. And they know of themselves what to see and hear, rather than being filtered through our mind. I know we might find this hard to believe, but we think way too much. We don't have much space between our thoughts. We just think. And by not having the space, we are compressing our incarnation so much that we cannot enjoy it. There's no space to enjoy it. Because what gives us joy is the emptiness, those moments when it's empty. If it's a thought that makes us happy, that thought will perish. If it's a thing that makes us happy, there is something within us that says, I better be careful because I can lose this thing. You know, you can have millions and millions of dollars and spend your whole life paranoid you're going to lose it. Then is that worth anything? So once you get past kindergarten, you realize that to live here properly, to be healthy, you need to train yourself to be healthy. Because most people today are crazy. And so crazy that we've accepted craziness as normal. And the people who are normal, many of them we say are crazy. So how do you know? There's one way that I know, and that is when it's real, when you're really in that stream, when you're touching heaven and earth, you feel it. You really, really feel it. It's real. It's palpable. You shine. Actual light. Actual shining. And if it's a moment, great, it's a moment. You know, one of the hardest things for me to learn is whenever I would have a wonderful experience, I would always tell myself, oh, how can I make this last? Well, if you learn anything about sex, it doesn't last forever. You know? There are moments. There are moments. And it's true in life too. It's not here to last forever. It's here as part of the process of our awakening. I asked a very, very enlightened human being a brilliant question, if I say so myself. I asked, are you always enlightened? And they gave me a great answer. They said, no, nobody is. You have your moments, you know, and maybe in the midst of some moments you won't be able to go buy furniture. Or maybe you'll have your moment right in the middle of buying furniture. And everything in between those moments is incredibly beautiful. Because we're alive, we're here, we might die at any moment. So one more thing, and then we'll pay attention to what David said and we'll make some sound. I give this teaching again and again and again because this is important. There was a woman in India, she's not alive anymore. Her name was Mother Krishnabai. And two of my teachers who would know both said the same thing to me. They said, well, she's probably the highest person in the world. And she was hidden in an ashram in southern India. Didn't have throngs of people going to her, but all of the really true sadhus and rishis and yogis would show up. It seemed to me on magic carpets, but they show up. And she was a very normal person, very humble person, completely functioning in God consciousness. So one day I asked her, what is enlightenment? You know, this thing we're striving for, what is it? She gave a remarkable answer. I had brought my kids there when they were little babies and to get her blessing. And, you know, they would come there. It was India, and it was India 38 years ago and 36 years ago, and it was rough. And if I knew now what I didn't know then, what I do know now, I would never have brought my infants there because I would have been too afraid. Now I would do it, but not then. And she would always get mad at us and say, what are you bringing your children? You know, why are you traveling with them? They can get sick and so on. And so I said, what is enlightenment? And she said, Shahabuddin, I've seen you with your children. And I said, yes. And she said, I know you love your children. I've seen it. And I said, yes. And she said, you love your children very much. And I said, yes. And she said, the way you feel about your children is the way I feel about every human being. That's enlightenment. I've never, ever gotten a better answer from anybody. That level of connection beyond the intellect, that level of caring, that level of protection, that level of loving is something that we reserve just for our family. And it is unimaginable to most people, assuming you have a normal, a loving family, I shouldn't say normal, a loving family, it is unimaginable to believe that we could feel that for everybody, somebody on the street who we never met. How could we possibly feel that? Well, because of what you said, it's one voice, it's one being. The only thing that exists is God. And as it evolves in us, that's what happens. And that's how humanity is going to grow and evolve. Because the love element in us is becoming greater every day. Maybe not in everybody, but it is growing. We've never, ever, ever had a global culture before. Same planet, the planet hasn't changed. The culture on it is radically different. We communicate with each other. We're compassionate about each other. If I said, hey, you know, there was that terrible tsunami in Japan, could everybody just chip in a dollar? I'd get many more dollars than $1 a person. Why? Because we know what it is. We've seen it. We've felt it. We've touched it. It's real. The globe, the people on it are becoming really connected. It's not just technological. It's spiritual. So we can function, and we can function as a collective being too. We're getting there. We really are. Now, the last words are something that I'll give you as a special bonus gift that you can take with you. Those of you who know it will probably be groaning in a moment, but I'd like to offer the four seas. And I don't mean the Mediterranean or anything like that. These are four words that begin with C, that if you remember them, you will have much, much, much more happiness in your life. Unless you remember them because you never do it. Then it won't work. So, the four C's. The first one is?
Complain not.
Complain not. We should probably stop there and make it the one C. But there is more. The next one?
Compare
not. Complain not, compare not. That will take care of 80% of things. Then the other 20% is criticize not. And the last is condemn not. Condemn not. Complain not, compare not, criticize not, condemn not. And then there is one more line, which is keep in the natural state. Stay attuned with the infinite. And if you have trouble doing that, practice the four C's and forget about the last line. Just really practice it consciously. You know, the spiritual path makes itself very complicated because that's a good way to sell books and fill up seminars. But actually, it's quite simple. And the golden rule is golden because it's real. Just think, would I want that done to me? Would I really want that done to me? Will I really want someone cutting me off in traffic? You know, do I really want someone who's had a rough day kind of mouthing off on me, taking it out on me? Do I really want to wish anybody illness? would I want that done to me? Do I want people envying something that I have, you know, comparing their life to mine and saying my life is better? No. So, compare not, complain not, criticize not, condemn not. Okay. So everybody, if you can, sit up straight. And just observe your breath for a moment. I'm not going to do a meditation. I'm just going to become aware of the breath. Be like a witness, an observer of your breath. So we're going to make a sound, and we're going to use a wonderful mantra, wonderful zikr. And we've spoken about it already, and the zikr is Hu. The mantra is Hu, meaning God, and Man, mind, God, mind. And we're going to do it. Join if you will. Let the sound work on you. It's magical. Just listen first, and we'll do it like this. Hu, 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 man. Hu, 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 man. Remember, what we're really saying is the sound of the human being, not the meaning. The sound of the human being. Hu, 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 man. Hu. Now take the sound out of your head and throat and bring it into the center of the chest. So we're not doing hoo, hoo, hoo. Instead we're doing hoo, hoo, hoo. Feel it in here. Ready? Hoo. Much better. Hoo. cleanse our intellect and very gently look at your day or yesterday. And if there's anything you did that you weren't 100% pleased with or proud of, just think of what that action was and very gently just say, who, very softly. No man, just who, thinking of that action until it's dissolved. And be open to the forgiveness that's ever present. That is constantly being offered to us. It's not business, it's not quid pro quo. It's not, I did good, I deserve this, I did bad, I should get punished. It's ever present for all human beings. And drink it into your heart, your mind. Thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly comes from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness, teach us thy loving forgiveness, raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide us, send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being. Amen. So deep thanks to all of you who have come tonight, old friends, new friends. And remember, all we have is each other. Nothing beyond each other. And that's more than enough. Thank you. I bless you.